welcome. Please take a seat. Great to have you all here. My name is Matt Williams. I'm the vicar here at St. James Old Cathedral. We're delighted to welcome you, and we're also thankful to Bunch of Blokes Project and Warren Mills especially for organising this conference and for Ethos for also supporting it. Today we're in for a treat, and I believe Jordan Peterson's ninth rule is, you know, listen to people and assume that they know stuff you don't. And one thing I know is that Paul knows a lot of stuff that I don't. So I'm here to listen, and I hope you are too, and to engage with the wisdom that he brings. So welcome, Paul, to this, and we're looking forward to learning from all that you've gleaned from years of really engaging with the Peterson phenomenon. Thank you.
It's with deep gratitude to Matt and St. James Old Cathedral that we're all here, and that Matt has accommodated me and my eccentricities, and now you're part of that, whether you like. I suppose a lot of people who have followed Peterson have engaged from the start, which I guess is it 2 years close?
Close.
Yeah. And I was one, and directed to Peterson via Jonathan Haidt, and I was immediately fascinated by his use of scientific knowledge and his integration of several disciplines. And it was his words about the logos in the big picture sense, but saying that we have a logos as individuals, and that it's our word, and that we had to take great responsibility for what we say. And that simple conviction led me to do a number of things that I now see. Some of them were quite painful, but I now see them as being really important steps that have led us here today. I can't remember exactly when I discovered Paul, but it was pretty early in the piece, I suppose. And it was another revelation, because Paul had a much, much bigger picture of what Peterson was doing and the way he integrated the Peterson phenomenon with the whole thing about archetypes and Jungian psychology, and was able to take it another step, which I found really inspiring and encouraging. So I began to watch Paul avidly. And I thought to myself, as I do, why don't I just invite him out to a conference? And he said yes. That was what really surprised me. And so here we are. And I had no idea as to whether it would be a fireside chat or a big group. Well, it's more a fireside chat than a big group. But I'm very grateful to each of you to be here. And I'm looking forward to what each person says, and particularly the feedback from the groups as to what you make of what's going on. And I should also mention one of the big intriguing factors is Paul's status as the pastor of the intellectual dark web. I just think that's fantastic. And also a title he's given Peterson, which is the unauthorized exorcist, which I hope he'll explain during the day. So we're in for a wild ride in some ways. And so I guess all of you know a bit about Paul anyway, but he's father of five, and Jared's here. Where are you, Jared? There he is down the back, hiding. We'll get you involved later on. And the pastor of a small church in a low socioeconomic area of Sacramento. That's a special qualification in my view. just like Peterson's a professional clinical psychologist, deals with real people, so does Paul. And he's a very funny guy. He's very graceful. He's amazingly knowledgeable and, again, able to integrate all of this knowledge. And so I'm looking forward to what Paul has to say as much as you. Thanks for being here.
I've actually turned it on this time, Leighton, so there you go. So I've already blotted my copybook with the sound guy, so... Look, most of our questions that we ask are not new. People have been wrestling with the same questions around and around for thousands of years. And so today we're going to punctuate our sessions just briefly by listening to an honest and probing thinker from a few thousand years ago. He speaks in the voice of King Solomon. And the book of Ecclesiastes complains and wonders, celebrates and despairs in turn. We call the book Wisdom. But it's perhaps not quite the wisdom you might expect from the Bible. The book is not a conclusion. It is not the Bible's conclusion anyway, or it is not the Bible's final word on the questions that he asks. But few people have ever asked their questions so well or whinged so beautifully. So we're going to just have little snippets from Ecclesiastes today, and we'll begin now at the beginning. The words of the teacher, the son of David, King in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, says the teacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What do people gain from all their toil by which they toil under the sun? A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun goes down and it hurries to the place where it rises. The wind blows to the south and goes round to the north. Round and round goes the wind and on its circuits the wind returns. All streams run to the sea, but the sea isn't full. To the place where the streams flow, they continue to flow. All things are wearisome. More than one can express. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, or the ear filled up with hearing. What has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done. And there is nothing new under the sun. Is there a thing of which it said, "Oh, see, this is new"? It's already been in the ages before us. The people of long ago are not remembered, nor will there be any remembrance of people yet to come by those who come after them.
It's a tremendous privilege and a great deal of fun to be here with you, with all of you today. If you had asked me 2 years ago if I would be in Australia talking about a professor of psychology from the University of Toronto who was turning fans of Sam Harris into people curious about Christianity and the Bible, I would have thought you were, like, Laura's fine. No, Laura's fine. I'm just kidding. I'm just kind of referencing this. So, yeah, that's good. I would have thought you were out of your mind. And then when Warren emails me, I don't know this man from anything, and he says, "I want you to come to Australia and speak at a conference about Jordan Peterson."
And I thought, well, this is surreal. And I kind of sent him an email back and said, are you serious? And he said, yes. And I thought, well, why not? Well, let's find a way and let's make it happen. And by the grace of God, it has. And a little bit later, I'm going to have a few more words about Warren when we talk about his book, because it's a delight. And so we've been putting this conference together, and we had hoped to do a conversation between myself and John Anderson and Jordan Peterson. That didn't happen for a variety of reasons, and John will talk a little bit about that. But John and I did have a conversation, and we did record that conversation. So before each of the sessions, we're going to play a clip about from my conversation with John Anderson, and then a little video clip that I selected of Jordan Peterson's work, and then I'll talk about it, which those of you who watch my YouTube channel understand that's sort of how we do things. So why don't you go ahead and play that clip?
Well, John, I really appreciate you, your willingness to speak with me today. I've watched a number of your videos. I appreciate your YouTube channel. I'd be curious to know how you came across Jordan Peterson and why he captured your interest, at least enough to do multiple conversations with him.
Well, Paul, can I say it's terrific to be talking to you and wonderful that you're giving time to us in Australia. I met Jordan personally when he was in Sydney just before Easter last year. And I'd heard of him, of course. And then there was the famous Cathy Newman interview in the BBC, which just went everywhere in Australia. So I was intrigued. And then I learned that he was giving 7 talks and every single one of them was booked out and people were clamoring for tickets. And we were in the process of putting together a website. We rang him, said, could we have a conversation? We have several in the can. We're about to launch, etc. Would you give us some time? And he was very gracious. As you and I know, he's very gracious with his time. And has given you time, he's given me time, he's given countless numbers of people around the world a lot of time. He immediately said yes. We recorded a conversation. I was absolutely intrigued with it. We share a love of history. He deeply cares about people and told a powerful story about young people coming up to him after a talk he'd given in Melbourne. And I was very much reached by that. But then what happened was that I was asked to compare an evening at Chatswood here in Sydney. Now, it's not a big hall, brand new, very nice hall, 1,000 people in it. Now, as a former public life figure, I can read a crowd. It's very interesting to me. There are 1,000 people there, and the bulk of them were youngish men, under 35. They gave him a standing ovation before he said a word. Now, this was a man who's not a rock star, he's not a super politician. Politicians, in fact, would die for a standing ovation before they began to talk. He's not a super sports star on the world stage. They knew him and they admired him and they wanted to welcome him. He spoke for 90 minutes on his rules for life. Another standing ovation, took 30 minutes question, another standing ovation. And what I saw there was that he was reaching people by virtue of his authenticity, his sheer intelligence, his knowledge of facts, and the fact that they knew, he understood, and cared.
Now, when you think about, when you say he's reaching young men especially, in what way do you see him reaching them? What are the tangible goods you see coming out of what he's offering them?
Well, I think particularly younger men in Western culture feel that they're often painted in terms of their simple masculinity, which they had no control over, as being somehow toxic. And that the world is divided into two classes, victims and victim makers, and that they, as particularly the sons of the patriarchy and of, in the case of Australia, some sort of terrible, white colonialist imperialism, that somehow they're the problem. And I think at the same time for many of them, as that sows confusion, what I observed that I found so interesting and actually rang true for me was that he was saying to them, it's not as if he was offering them some sort of, fluffy feel-good stuff. he was actually saying, look, you know you're not the person you ought to be. You know you need to sort yourself out. The world's a tough place, and you've got personal issues. You're not the person you ought to be. In fact, you're a terrible person. The more you look at yourself, the more terrible you are. Well, I know that's true of me. The more reflective I am, the more I realize I come up short. And what struck me, he was striking a chord of deep understanding and honesty that young people are not given credit for. And he's belled the cat. Mm-hmm. So he says, you know, go back to your room, tidy your room, sort yourself out. It's code, if you like, for start with yourself. I love that line of his that says, redemption won't come through the political process. It'll come at the level of the individual.
Yeah. What question are you asked way too seldom? Oh, well, that's pretty easy. At least if the question is, what question am I asked by journalists way too seldom? And the answer to that would be, Dr. Peterson, what the hell is going on? And what I mean by that is, why are so many people coming to your lectures, let's say, and why did your book strike such a chord? I think the first one is the most important one. You know, generally what happens with journalists is that they're very cynical about what is happening at my lectures and also who's attending. And it's really very pejorative, demeaning, thoughtless, prejudiced, and I would say cruel all at once. Because the first assumption is that, you know, I'm talking primarily to angry white young men. And there certainly isn't a lot of evidence for that. I would say the average age of the people in my audience is 30s. And that's not exactly young. And then I would say, well, it's at least 30% women. And that's been increasing as the book has sold more. And, you know, the reason it was men primarily to begin with, I think, is because, well, there are many men starving for an encouraging voice. And also the fact that YouTube, which is where I picked up my primary audience to begin with, skews about 80-20 male to female in terms of its viewership, which really doesn't have anything to do with me, right? That's just a, what do you call that? That's a baseline phenomena that has to be taken into account before you make any, before you draw any conclusions about the nature of someone's audience. But the presumption is that, you know, I'm speaking politically and in a divisive way to the people who show up to my lectures and to my talks. And that's just not true. The lectures aren't political except peripherally. I mean, I do now and then throw a critical comment or two out about the manner in which this strange alliance of postmodernism and neo-Marxism has been dominating the university, but I think that's a perfectly reasonable thing to point out. Apart from that, the lectures almost all concentrate on psychological self-improvement, and it seems almost impossible for the media to be not cynical about that. You know, I think it's partly because almost everything that the classic media covers has to be politicized. And I was on a show, for example, called Q&A, an Australian show, which was, it's their biggest political show. It's modeled on one in the UK, which is also quite big, which I was also on a while back. And every issue immediately becomes discussed among polarized political lines. It's as if our discourse has degenerated to the point where the only possible response to a question about anything important has to be ideological, so left or right, and it has to be political. And so I think part of the problem is perhaps that the phenomenon that constitutes the attendance at my lectures doesn't fit the standard news media narrative, which is driven by journalists, I think, who had political ambitions fundamentally, or still have political ambitions of one sort or another, and who tend to view the world only through a political lens. So anyways, that's a very long answer to that question. But it is, see, it's so interesting to me that the journalists who interview me have no curiosity about why it is that so many people are coming to watch my lectures. It's like the curiosity has been boiled out of them in some sense, because it certainly makes me curious. Every time I go on stage and there's 3,500 people there, I'm curious about why they're there. And so we have a discussion about all these things that I've been talking about. And I can tell you too, that the one thing that really brings the house to dead silence, which is very much worth paying attention to, is the discussion. Anytime I have a discussion about the relationship between responsibility and meaning, you know, because one of the fundamental theses of 12 Rules for Life and also of Maps of Meaning is that because life is essentially tragic in its fundamental essence, you need a sustaining meaning that's deep and profound, and deep and profound enough to get you through bad times, because there will be very bad times in your life. There'll be death, and there'll be illness, and there'll be disappointment of all sorts. And there'll be just the standard difficulties of life in the world to contend with. And you really must have something that's profound and powerful to set up against that. And I think that your voluntary adoption of the struggle to improve being is the proper antidote to that. And that the best way to do that is to live responsibly and truthfully. I truly believe that. And I think that people know this, you know, because when I talk to my audiences about exactly this, about who they admire, for example, you know, it's like, well, you don't admire people who lie and cheat and deceive. You don't teach your children to do that. You admire people who keep their word, who are honest and reliable, and you want them around, especially in times of trouble. And you want people who are capable of being responsible for themselves and to take care of themselves properly as if they matter, as a moral duty. And then you also want people who have extended themselves past that so that they can take care of their family and regard that as a noble and appropriate enterprise, and who are reliable for their children and for their husbands and wives. And then you want people who are capable of extending themselves even beyond that and taking care of the community. And when I talk about that, and that's meaning, it's where you find the meaning in your life if you're looking for it. It's not in happiness. And it's not an impulsive pleasure. None of that works for any length of time. And it tends to kick back hard. And it's certainly not something that's going to get you through rough times. It's the ability to pick up a heavy load of responsibility and to move forward with it. And what's so interesting is that every time I talk about this with my audiences, they're reduced to complete silence. And I think there's something, and that's, you know, I've noticed that in 150 different cities now. And it's something you really have to take seriously when you see it happening over and over. And I do believe that a huge part of the reason that people are coming to watch my lectures and to buy my book, the lectures, of course, have more direct impact on me than the book sales, although the book sales now have approached 3 million copies, which is quite something, in hardcover around the world. And they're not translated into all the languages they're going to be translated into. That's, I think, 50 languages is what they're slated for now. But the lectures have more impact on me because I get to see the audience and then to talk to people afterwards, you know, and they tell me the same thing. Many people who come up to me in the meet and greets, because people can come and talk to me after the lecture. There's special tickets arranged for that. That's handled by a particular company. And they tell me, you know, they've been trying to develop a vision for their life and to act more responsibly and to speak more truthfully and to take more responsibility. Maybe I already said that. And that the changes in their lives have been overwhelming as a consequence. Merely trying to just speak the truth or not lie has had a huge effect on many of the people that I've talked to. And it's And it's not a simple thing to do, you know, and it's a risky thing because the consequences of speaking the truth in the short term, especially if you're not very practiced at it, can be quite devastating, which is, of course, why people don't do it. But the medium to long-term consequences are extremely beneficial, and it's what sets the world straight. And so what question are you asked way too seldom? Well, Dr. Peterson, don't you think that it's interesting that so many people are coming to your lectures that are fundamentally psychological and philosophical in nature, and apparently doing so because they're really trying hard to get their lives together? It's like, yeah, I think that's really interesting, and it's a question that's really worth pursuing. It's the only question that's worth pursuing as far as I'm concerned, because it's a real mystery that there's such a demand for this. I can't fathom it. I think it's been a source of tremendous optimism to me that people have that burning desire for a more profound dialogue.
You hear a lot about Jordan Peterson. Go to the next slide. That is Jordan Peterson. You know his heart when you hear him break down, and you'll see it again and again. And there's a lot of stuff going on around him, but if you want to know what the center of he and his life is, you can see it when he starts to break down, because that's who he is. Now, there's a James Beverly, who I don't know personally, has taken it upon himself to do a little Amazon book about understanding Jordan Peterson, and the best use of that Amazon book is the outline in it, where he has links and outlines of a whole bunch of things about Jordan Peterson. 1970s, Jordan Peterson is 1 year older than I am, and he grew up during the Cold War, and he grew up understanding that nuclear missiles were facing the United States and the Soviet Union, and that even with a simple mistake, the world could be blown apart, and the center of that conflict was a story. At 1993 to 97, he taught at Harvard, and you can find on YouTube a variety of his lectures there. He was already working out what he would publish in 1999, which was a 15-year project, a book called Maps of Meaning, which is, as a friend of mine said, nearly inscrutable. It is a difficult book, but the book, in my opinion, is a tortured book because he was working out his faith in fear and trembling through that book. And you hear him describe it. He says every sentence of that book he pored over 15 times to try to get the language right. That book was published, no waves. Almost nobody read the book. 2004, Jordan Peterson was quite often on Ontario Public Television. Ontario Public Television, I don't know what public television is like in Australia. In the United States, public television is something that everyone thinks is a good idea, but not everybody watches. And Jordan Peterson was kind of a wonky, nerdy guy who would go on about meaning. And all of the things now that he is terribly famous for, he was speaking for years and years and years on Ontario Public Television, and just a few people watched. All that changed in May of 2016 when the Ontario legislature decided to pass a bill that, in Jordan Peterson's opinion, enforced speech. Jordan Peterson had, like many of us, seen the new wave of new pronouns coming, and the Ontario legislature basically made refusal of using someone's preferred pronoun a violation of their human rights and subject to sanction by the appropriate governmental committees. And Jordan Peterson thought that this was an infringement on free speech. So one night, probably September 26, his wife was away, and this was gnawing at him, and he usually would get up in the middle of the night and write if he couldn't sleep, but he'd been playing around with YouTube, so he decided to sit in front of his computer and do a bit of a screed about this legislation and posted it. September 28, the National Post picked up the story. By October 3, even though everybody said, oh, Jordan, this is overblown,
He had received two letters from his employer, the University of Toronto, telling him that he should take his video down and stop making noises about this, or they may fire him. On November 28, 2016, he had a first appearance on Joe Rogan. One of the things that I ask people all the time is, where did you first hear about Jordan Peterson? Joe Rogan is one of the key places that many young men heard about Jordan Peterson. Before Jordan Peterson, I had never even heard of Joe Rogan. October 12, 2016, Jordan Peterson went to school that day, and there was a protest. And he said, well, who's this protest about? Because there's protests on campuses. Someone said, it's about you. And so he goes down there, and the protesters, of course, have a phone in his face. And he's down there, and someone comes in his face and says, how do you feel about their Nazis being at your protest? And he's like, I didn't organize the protest. He says, I hate Nazis. And this was the first video I had seen of Jordan Peterson. Next slide. The suspender video. People heard that he might be fired, and so suddenly his little Patreon account gets flushed with people who are concerned that somehow the University of Toronto is going to silence him. And it continues to grow from there. May 16, 2017, Jordan Peterson rents the Isabel Bader Theater in Toronto and begins his biblical series. And what he does is he stands up and for 2 hours, a guy who most of his Bible knowledge comes from public domain sources he could find on BibleHub.com, something which I as a pastor, and you see all the commentaries behind me, was like, this is where you're getting your information? But I find this, and I find here is a guy who knows, in terms of the type of knowledge I have about the Bible, almost nothing, no training in it, doesn't go to church. He is standing up for 2 hours in a 600-seat theater, charging $40 a head. And personal friends of mine who are quite outstanding preachers in Toronto, Canada, have plenty of empty pews for nothing. What is going on? And so I think, well, maybe Jordan Peterson is some evangelical who somehow managed to stay undercover at the University of Toronto, and now he's a conservative Christian upset by the tide in society, and I listened to his biblical lecture. No, that's not him. He believes in Darwin. He loves Jung. What is going on? January 2018, Jordan Peterson had been working on a book that he had kind of been stealthily sourcing via Quora, which is an online question and answer forum. And he was trying to figure out what kinds of questions are people most interested in. So he'd try questions and things would kind of get voted up. And so he took the 12 most popular questions he had and said, I'm going to make a book about this. This is before any of this stuff happened. And he starts writing it. Well, the book timing couldn't have been more perfect. January 2018, after all of this, the book is released. January 17, he has an interview with Kathy Newman on BBC4, and she keeps dogging him, and he calmly deflects, and this video goes viral. And then his book tour begins. And whereas before he had sold out a little theater of 600 people, now he's going all over the world, and every place he goes, his venues sell out for $50 or $100 or $150 a ticket. And for another $100, you can get 30 seconds with him, shake his hand, and get your picture taken. Jordan Peterson is exactly right about the question we should be asking. What is going on? Now, certainly part of Jordan Peterson's rise has everything to do with this moment in the ongoing culture war in the West. And those of you who have watched my videos know that I have hours of content talking about the history of Christianity and the Protestant Reformation and the rise of the Enlightenment and all of that stuff. All of that I'll have to condense down today in these three little talks. But in a loose sense, in a far more complex way, politics is applied religion. Now, here, a loose sense in a complex way, because those two factors are very deep in this. It's sort of like technology is applied science. In the pre-modern period, of course, politics was religion and religion was politics. Jordan Peterson is really the cornerstone of what Eric Weinstein dubbed the intellectual dark web. Now, somehow via David Fuller and Rebel Wisdom in the comment section, I get dubbed the pastor of the intellectual dark web, and I think this is the strangest church anyone could ever conceive of, because we've got one practicing Jew in Ben Shapiro, and we've got a whole bunch of atheists, including Sam Harris, and this is my fold, and then you've got Jordan Peterson. And we'll talk a lot about him. But it's everyone wants to, as Peterson notes, place this in a political context. And if I were Jordan Peterson's handler, I would tell him, stay off Fox News, stay off CPAC, stay away from the political stuff. But Jordan Peterson won't. That's not how he is. But this isn't primarily, in my opinion, a political thing. There's a political aspect to it. That's certainly true. But if you look at the intellectual dark web, myself, and this of course shocks people who listen to me, and I'll get into my background a little bit later, I voted for Bernie Sanders in the California primary. Think about that. So did Eric and Eric Weinstein and his brother Brett. I've been a lifelong Democrat. I've never voted for a Republican. I voted for other parties, but so it's not about politics. Sam Harris was a Hillary supporter. Ben Shapiro, he's a political conservative pundit in the States. This is not primarily about politics. But that, of course, as Peterson, I think, rightly articulated, is the lens through which journalism in the United States works, partly because it's a commercial enterprise and it sells. I was raised in Paterson, New Jersey by Stan and Barb Vanderclay in a racial reconciliation church, which was a weird mixture of Dutch Calvinism and poor black individuals that had moved up to grimy little Paterson, New Jersey and struggled to live. And so I remember at a young age hearing that African Americans were only 10% of the American population, and I was shocked because everyone around me was black. The church I pastor in Sacramento, California is incredibly diverse. It's a very small church, but it's incredibly diverse. We've got, here's a chief of staff for a Democrat in the legislature. Some of these individuals would never in their life vote for a Democrat. Others are apolitical, some are fiercely political, but it is diverse, and one of the things that I am most proud of about my little church is that politics does not define nor divide us. We are Christians. We can have vigorous conversations about politics, but we are one in Christ. And I think one of the greatest tragedies we've seen in the world is that too often, at least in the United States, churches are divided by their politics. And so then when people in my denomination, I have long been known as, in a sense, a liberal in a very conservative denomination like the Christian Reformed Church. Why on earth am I talking about Jordan Peterson? There are a good number of my friends who would like me to just stop, because you shouldn't get mixed up in Jordan Peterson. You shouldn't be associated with him. You shouldn't talk about him. But I won't stop, because I think what is happening here is vitally important and has far more to do than with the world than Donald Trump or Barack Obama or Democrats or Republicans or whatever shape your politics are here in Australia. One of the key issues that has been raised by the intellectual dark web is, can only the wealthy afford free speech? And as Brett Weinstein and Joe Rogan commented, well, part of what holds this group of mostly atheists together is all of them have what they say is FU money. They can't be fired, so they can stand up and speak the truth. And partly because I've been at my church 20 years, I can engage in these conversations because my church trusts me. They don't watch my videos. They think, well, we know Paul, he's okay. He always does crazy things. Now he's making videos. And now complete strangers show up to the church and I start a meetup, and mostly atheists now come into the church. And these atheists, well, what is this about? Well, I don't know, but they seem okay. And we have little jobs to do. The atheists pitch a hand. And when some of the atheists realize, well, it's a small, fragile little church that's always on the edge economically. One guy who just a few years ago thought all Christian believers were psychopaths and lunatics says, you know, boy, I'd better give them some money so this church stays open, because where will we have our meetups? What on earth is going on? One of the earlier pieces that came up was a guy named Bernie Schiff, who was one of the people that first brought Jordan Peterson to the University of Toronto. And this is a piece that he posted in The Star. He said, several years ago, Jordan Peterson told me he wanted to buy a church. This was long before he became known as the most influential public intellectual in the Western world. That was a quote from David Brooks. As he was described in the pages of the New York Times a few months ago, it was before he was fancied to be a truth-telling sage who inspired legions and the author of one of the best-selling books in the world this year. He was just my colleague and friend. I assumed that it was for a new home, because all over the world, especially in the West, churches are being converted into all kinds of things, because what would you do with a great big building with a massive hall where nobody wants to come and listen to a preacher talk about the Bible? There was a trend in Toronto of converting religious spaces, vacant because of their dwindling congregations, into stylish lofts. But he corrected me. He wanted to establish a church, he said, in which he would deliver sermons every Sunday. Well, that's interesting. So who is this Jordan Peterson? Well, I, like Jordan Peterson, I had blogged for years and nobody paid any attention. And I had a YouTube channel where I posted my sermons, and maybe if a member missed a Sunday, they could watch one. And I started a show called The Freddie and Paul Show, where a member of my congregation once said, Pastor Paul, you and I should have a TV show. And I said, really, Fred? He said, yeah, and I didn't feel like going down to public access. And so I said, I'll tell you what, Fred, I'll just use my phone and we'll make a little show together, and we'll call it the Freddie and Paul Show, and I'll post it on YouTube. And I had 15 subscribers. But then I started thinking about Jordan Peterson, and I wanted a few more conversation partners, and I just read Neil Postman's book, Amusing Ourselves to Death, and I thought, there's something about Peterson and YouTube. And so I decided, well, how hard can it be? I'll sit down in front of my computer and I'll make a video about three reasons why I think Jordan Peterson is important, and I'll post it on my YouTube channel. And maybe 50 people will see it, and maybe I'll have a dozen new conversation partners, and that'll be fun. And then I woke up the next morning and I had 300 subscribers. And by the end of the week, I had 600. And by Sunday, I had 1,000. And I thought, no, this is not what I was looking for. And then the email started coming. And the next week in church, a guy shows up and he's got a little poster for me that's behind me on YouTube. And he says, I've never been to church in my life, but I saw you on YouTube, so here I am. And he helps run our meetups now. And I started getting emails and letters and notes and gifts from people who were saying things like, I was a huge atheist and then I listened to Jordan Peterson and I'm not so sure anymore. My life was going in a terrible direction and I didn't know what to do. And I listened to Jordan Peterson and I started applying what he said. I started to try to tell the truth. I started to try to take responsibility. Job contacted me from the Netherlands. Dennis, Lars, Eric. Lars was a Christian beforehand, but had always suffered from depression. Started listening to Jordan. He had struggled with depression for a number of years and had kind of gotten better. And then he had had a bicycle accident, suffered traumatic brain injury, and didn't know what to do, and he'd heard about Jordan Peterson before, started listening to his lectures almost compulsively, because when he listened to Jordan Peterson, the depression would lift. Job says nearly the same thing to me. Dennis says nearly the same thing to me. Eric talks about his nihilism. He was a math student at University of Notre Dame, very much anti-Christian, starts listening to Jordan Peterson, and his world starts coming together, and he feels so much better about himself. And these are just the people who are willing to not only talk to me, but allow me to record their conversations and post them on the internet. If you look at my channel, you see the videos in which I ramble, and you'll see videos of conversation, and person after person after person talk about Jordan Peterson made my life better. And what was really strange was that someone comes to you and they say they're depressed. Well, let's get them on a drug. Well, would you believe sitting and watching hours of a psychologist ramble about the Bible would lift people's depression? You wouldn't think that could happen. I've got plenty of testimony that says, in fact, it's happening all the time. Glenn Scrivener, an Aussie, now lives in the UK. He's an evangelist. He found his way to my channel. And he says to me, I go to events all the time and young men come up to me and they say, I've been listening to Jordan Peterson and I'm thinking about Christianity. To him, it's obvious what's going on. Father David Lewis, Orthodox priest, watched my channel, heard I was doing meetups, said, well, maybe I can try one. Opened his doors in Dallas, Texas. 10 people showed up. People wanting to say, well, I'm an atheist, I don't believe in God, but I'm going to come to an Orthodox church and talk to a guy with a black robe and a long beard about God. What is going on? John Vervaeke is a colleague of Jordan Peterson, and poor John has kind of gotten swept up in all the Jordan Peterson stuff, and he's a little disturbed by it because he's not at all political, and he's very comfortable with his employer, and he's not in any hot water. But John Vervaeke has been talking for a while about the meaning crisis. And I think part of the reason Jordan Peterson is huge is exactly this. Alistair Roberts is a scholar in England, terribly brilliant man, right away got on the Jordan Peterson thing, conservative, reformed Christian like myself. And he says, I'm talking to him about Jordan Peterson, saying, Jordan's going to misstep. Alistair says, don't worry, the stuff that's beneath this is not going away. Jordan Peterson is a sign of what is happening that we should pay attention to. There's a great dislocation that is happening. The New York Times runs October 11, 2017, why are more American teenagers than ever suffering from severe anxiety? Why indeed? And most often the answer is a pharmaceutical. Pharmaceuticals aren't causing the depression and anxiety. There's something deeper happening in the long story of the West. The church has been losing ground in the West for a very long time. You should read Charles Taylor's A Secular Age. It's almost as impossible to read as Jordan Peterson's Maps of Meaning. But it's an important book, and you'll hear people talk about it all the time. After 9/11, new atheism came on with a vengeance. Because during the Cold War, the United States, church attendance in the United States reached its peak during the Cold War, not in the 19th century, not in the colonial period, during the Cold War. Because that's when in the United States we put "In God We Trust" on our coins. We put "One Nation Under God" in our Pledge of Allegiance during the Cold War. Why? Because we had an existential crisis and confrontation with godless communism. These were the formative years of Jordan Peterson. 9/11 marked the turning of a page. Now Americans are afraid of what? Religious fundamentalists and their terrorism. Many I've seen as a pastor are going from Christianity to a pantheistic spirituality. Another important book to read by Christian Smith, now a sociologist at Notre Dame, in the late 90s did a pervasive survey of young people. Young people raised atheist, Muslim, Baptist, Presbyterian, Mormon. And what he discovered was that all of these young people, regardless of the churches they were raised in, had predominantly the same spiritual posture. He called it moralistic therapeutic deism. that somehow there was a God up there that was supposed to help them in their lives, but for the most part was disconnected from the rest of the world. And what I had seen going on with people leaving the church was that they would usually go in two directions. They'd go towards atheism and Sam Harris, or they'd go towards some kind of a pantheistic spirituality that, well, they'd talk to the universe and they'd, you know, maybe believe in crystals and they'd do all these things. And for the most part, as a pastor, I saw all of that as a one-way street. When someone went to Sam Harris, they didn't come back. When someone went to pantheism, they didn't come back. And Jordan Peterson came along, and who starts knocking at my door? Atheists and pantheists. And I thought, huh, why is Jordan Peterson turning these people around and giving them another idea that says, maybe I should look at that Bible. Maybe I should think in a new way about the church. Maybe Christianity has something to say. And I thought, what pastor in his right mind who's paying attention is not going to pay attention to this? As a small church pastor, I can go for weeks and months without having a substantive conversation with a determined atheist. And now, after making a few videos about Jordan Peterson, I don't have enough time to talk to all the atheists and pantheists that want to have conversations with me. And a good number of these people are young people in the church that were on their way in that direction, and Jordan Peterson made them pause. I run a small church, and as running a small church, we try to have all kinds of ideas about, well, how can we bring in people from the community? And we're happy to just have them darken the door. So we'll do a little fun fair. We'll do a Halloween thing. We'll give out candy. And churches pride themselves on how many children they can get there to receive candy. And then maybe we'll give them a Bible tract. And for the most part, all of this supposedly evangelistic activity produces next to nothing in terms of substantive conversation, contact, and relationship, but that's the primary mode of what churches call outreach. And all I do is for $85, I get an account with meetup.com, and I say, Jordan Peterson meetup at Living Stones. And a dozen people show up the first night, most of them saying, I would never enter a church building, but now I want to sit down with a pastor and talk about whether or not there is a God and whether the Bible is full of hooey and what's going on in the world. And I think, why isn't every pastor in Sacramento doing this? And then people start visiting the church, and my church members are kind of like, well, it's easier than vacation Bible school. And they're even giving money. Now, the next two talks, we're going to look at what happened to God in the last 500 years and how does Jordan Peterson change that trajectory. I think Jordan Peterson could be the most significant figure in this story since Charles Darwin, and I'll explain why. That'll be the second talk. The third talk, meaning, is Jordan Peterson's sacrament. Now, we're going to have to talk about sacraments, and I got a chance to meet Matt yesterday, and we're going to talk about the changes in church, at least I know, of course, best in the United States and in California, the changes in church that have been going on in the last 30, 40 years. And I was talking to Matt, and I was looking at your beautiful sanctuary, and I was saying, this is the new hotness in Sacramento church planting. You might not feel it yet in Australia. Warren tells me that everything starts in California and moves out from there. So once it gets across the ocean, you might have to work on some more cathedrals here, because Lord willing, they'll be full to want to hear what you're doing. That's what we pray for. Neo-sacramentalism, and we'll talk about what I mean by that term. We are continuing the conversation started by the Protestant Reformation. when I was in seminary, when I was growing up in Christian school, all of the ways that we talked about the main issues of the Protestant Reformation all seemed like settled stuff. With Jordan Peterson, all of those conversations are coming alive. What are we doing when Jesus says, "This is my body, this is my blood"? What does baptism mean? What's happening around Jordan Peterson has everything to do with all of those conversations. Well, I didn't quite know how long this was going to take, and we're ahead of schedule. That leaves time for questions. Any questions for clarification? One of the things we're going to do today is have a fair amount of time for conversation. And when Warren and I were talking about this event, that's something that I really asked for, because this is what I've learned from the meetups. People need to talk. Part of what's happened, especially in Protestant churches, and Matt and I talked about this yesterday, a lot of what we have are preachers talking people to death. Preacher talks, you listen. There's a place for that. But what I've learned in terms of evangelism and discipleship is people need to talk themselves into what they're going to believe next. They need to process it. One of the real deficiencies that I've seen in what Jordan Peterson is doing is that you go to a Jordan Peterson event and 3,000 people show up, and he talks at you for an hour and a half, just a little bit of question and answer, and you go home. And I was actually talking to a guy, I've made a lot of new friends in this. He had the same experience I did. You go to a Jordan Peterson event, you sit down, you listen to him talk. At the end of it, a lot of people say, "I wish there was someone I could talk to about this," because there's no one. When I first started my meetup, it was mostly men, some women, and most of the men said, "Yeah, I really want to talk about this stuff." And when I try talking to my wife about this, they don't want to talk about it. They say, "Oh, that Jordan Peterson stuff, you just watch his videos, I'm not really interested." So then they come to the meetup and they say, "Can we talk about this? What do I do at my meetups? I don't even open with prayer," which for me is a very difficult thing. But we talk, and people cuss, and people share their atheist views. People say what's sincerely on their heart. It's a place where they can do this, be taken seriously, and we engage them. Any questions? Yes, Ross.
So just to perhaps frame some of the breakout discussions we're going to have, I think there's at least two key questions, and hopefully we'll get into this. One is, what is going on with the popularity of Jordan Peterson, which you've touched on? And I think the other one that you touched on in recent lectures on YouTube is, what can the church do about this? How can we link up with this phenomenon? But just to sort of frame that, you've got this great dialogue about Oz Gibbs, talking about there's the individual leader, but then there's the institutions that have got to come in behind it. Could you just elaborate on the Oz Gibbs reference that you often make?
Oz Gibbs has this terrific quote: "Without the individual, nothing changes. Without institutions, nothing lasts." One of the initial questions I had for Jordan Peterson, and actually this friend of mine in Nashville, part of what's happened through my channel is I talk on my channel and people listen, and they go to these Jordan Peterson events and they get my questions to him. And so he got the question up to Jordan Peterson. He gave him the Oz Gibbs quote, and Jordan Peterson kind of shrugged. And I thought, oh, that's right. Jordan has been on a status rocket, and I think he's in many ways just trying to figure out what to do from one day to the next. He was just at, this just broke last night, I got a message from Esther O'Reilly. She's a blogger. Jordan Peterson was at the convocation of Liberty University, and part of me was like, oh, we're back with political stuff with the United States because Jerry Falwell Jr. and all that. But it's a crazy thing. Jordan Peterson is giving the convocation at Liberty University. That's a dispensational, fundamentalist, largest Christian university in the United States. And he's up there on stage, and Jordan Peterson, about 50 minutes into it, a man comes, charges the stage, and says, Jordan, I just needed to meet you. I'm in real trouble. I need real help. And And as I told this story to Warren this morning, and Jerry Falwell Jr. is known for keeping a gun on him even when he's on stage talking to the people, and glad he didn't shoot the guy when he charged the stage. But what's going on with this? And Peterson gave the similar answers that we'll talk about today. But here my question as a pastor was, when I watched this Jordan Peterson stuff going, who's going to come along and talk to the people? So one of the things I started with my channel was people would approach me and they'd want to talk. I'm the pastor. What do I do? I sit down. What's your story? Tell me your story. And they share their story. And they share their story any way they can. One of the things, why don't you go back to the slide where that has the picture of my church. Oh, a few more forward.
Oh, sorry, I went past it.
Yeah. Okay. So this is the church I grew up in. This was a potluck in this church. My father, Stan Vanderclay, knew nothing of African Americans when he went to Paterson, New Jersey in 1960. And he went to Paterson and he looked around and he saw there are a lot of poor black folks. Paterson is an urban town in the industrial Northeast. Alexander Hamilton looked over the Great Falls of Paterson, New Jersey and said, this would be a great industrial town. And it's been a place where poor immigrants have come ever since. So the Dutch came at the end of the 19th century. In World War I, the immigration stopped, and the black folks leaving poor Jim Crow South migrated up to the jobs in the North and stayed there through the 20th century. But they came, they were poor, they didn't have skills, there was racism and discrimination, and it was hard. And so my father came. Now, I'm going to break up. My father came and poured his life out in that community. And so often what people needed was, Rev, can you help me move my stove? Rev, I don't have any food. Rev, I'm going to jail, and can someone just talk to the judge and see if he'll give me a break this time? And they started a heroin rehabilitation center, which was right next door to the church. And so I grew up in church with people trying to get clean from heroin. And I watched my father pour his life out, one person at a time, for all of these individuals, people whose name we'll never know. Jordan Peterson can stand on stage and give an inspirational message, but the reason I started meetups was, how do we change as individuals? I know that as a pastor, we change by looking at each other in the eye. We change by telling our stories. We change by, a little later I'm going to talk about is Augustinian anthropology. We change by sharing and saying, these are the places in my life I'm not proud of. These are the places in my life that God needs to change because I have no power. Jordan Peterson can give an inspirational message. But the real work of individuals sorting themselves out, where can that happen? The church. Why? The church has been doing this for thousands of years. Jordan Peterson isn't going to start an institution or an organization that can sit down with men and women who are saying, I kind of want to act like God is real, but I simply don't believe. Who's going to be with them for those conversations of hours and hours and hours? Who's going to be with them when they say, I think I want to start to pray, but I don't know how? Pastors, small group leaders, the mature members of the church. Today, one of the things we're going to do is look at Warren's book. And I was reading Warren's book over the last few days. And it's a lovely book of a mature Christian man who has worked out his faith and his mind through all of the things. But he's also a deeply practical man. And he says, You know where this all matters? Where the rubber hits the road. So with Jordan Peterson, a lot of things can change, but there's going to have to be an institution that has buildings and chairs and staff and people and coffee mugs and potlucks and lots of people with all of their own stories. Where buckos and atheists and people who struggle can come in and say, can someone listen to me and care about me? as an individual. Jordan Peterson isn't going to do that. My idea is that's what the church should do. Isn't that what we've always said is our job? So you're exactly right. Billy, I often liken Jordan Peterson to Billy Graham in terms of, now, Jordan Peterson is nowhere as big as Billy Graham was. Jordan Peterson can fill a 2,000, 3,000, 5,000 seat venue. Billy Graham could fill Yankee Stadium. It was a different time. It was a different way. One of the things that Billy Graham did was he lined up the churches behind him because he knew the show's going to go someplace, but it's the people. It's all of the people, each with their own individual stories and struggles. They're the ones that matter. How can the institution make space for them? Thank you, Ross. Any other questions? Yes.
By the way, it was in Melbourne that 130,000 filled the Melbourne cricket ground at Graham's last meeting here. I think that was a world record.
Really?
Probably India beat it, but in terms of a space.
Wow.
Yeah, I was there, kid. How do you regard Peterson? Is he like a kind of a secular something prophet, or is he a bit like Cyrus? Being used by God to support God's program.
Jonathan Peugeot's likening is Cyrus. Esther O'Reilly calls him a noble pagan. I call him the unauthorized evangelist, or the unauthorized exorcist. There's a lovely story in the Gospels where there's somebody, not of Jesus' disciples, who's going around casting out demons in Jesus' name. And the disciples look around and they want to defend their intellectual property. And they say, he's casting out demons in your name, Jesus. Should we go and stop him? And Jesus says, leave him alone. If he's not against us, he's for us. Now, in the Gospels, that gets turned a couple of ways. But in my opinion, that's who Jordan Peterson is. He is doing an exorcism on Western society right now. And he's doing it through individual people. Now, right away, that's going to trigger a lot of conversations, demons, spirits, all of that. And a lot of my atheist friends would take a step back and think, yeah, now the Christians are talking crazy like they usually do. But functionally, that's what's happening. He's the unauthorized exorcist. And that's, at least right now, if the video gets publicly released from Liberty University convocation, right there in that video, and Esther O'Reilly, who's been a blogger on Young Fogey on Patheos, quickly wrote an article this morning, and I posted it. I sent it to Warren. I put it on my blog. This is what's happening right now, and it's happening live, and it's phenomenal to watch. So that's my take on him, the unauthorized exorcist. Yes?
Isn't there a danger, though? I'm a huge fan of his work, and I love that we're having a conversation. But isn't it just possible that the thing that really draws people to him is the notion that they can help themselves and lift themselves up, and that there isn't repentance required? That he who does not gather with me scatters. That are we gathering people to a message of repentance, or are we trying to come in underneath a movement where everybody's trying to carry their own stuff?
I think you're, and when I get to the third lecture, I think you're exactly right about what he's doing. But I also know as a pastor, when we have a problem, what is the first thing we try to do? Fix our own problem. Say you go to a 12-step program. What's the first step you have to deal with at the 12-step program? I can't fix my problem. We usually only arrive at that position because we've strived to do it in our own strength. And there's going to be a lot of people who listen to Jordan Peterson, and they're very motivated, and they're cleaning their room, and they're ordering their life. And again, part of what I did a video fairly early on the second and the third chapter in the book about the lobster, because one of the things that I grew up in Patterson. I was a missionary in the Dominican Republic, and I didn't put any pictures of that in. But my 7 years in the Dominican Republic reinforced something that I learned implicitly in Patterson, was that in the Dominican Republic, I worked with Haitians who were cutting sugarcane and picking coffee. And these people, according to any earthly scheme, have zero chance at anything that we in the West would regard as a good life. They will, for their whole lives long, do menial tasks, suffer from abuse and discrimination, and they will die, and no one will remember their name. According to the measures of this world, do those people have any hope? And in fact, most of human history has lived that life. In the gospel, with the resurrection, they have hope. And when I worked with poor Haitians worshiping God in hovels in the Dominican Republic, they experienced meaning. They experienced hope. They knew that their whole life long, they didn't have a chance. Can Jordan Peterson offer them that? But what is Jordan Peterson offering in terms of an opportunity for the church now? And to say, Jordan, you're deficient according to our metrics. Oh, okay, we do that to each other, don't we? The Baptists tell the Presbyterians they're deficient. The Pentecostals tell the Baptists they're deficient. The Anglicans tell the Pentecostals they're deficient. We play that games with each other. What's the missional moment right now? And I believe that Jesus Christ has an answer for the age of decay where the little people die and no one remembers their name because God knows. So it's a great question. Time for one more question. Yes?
Maybe switch a little bit. I'm presuming that most people in this room are Protestant, probably not Orthodox.
Not all.
Not all? We've
got a few bits here.
Okay. Well, certainly I don't know much about Orthodox Christianity, but I've noticed how many people have shown an interest from the Orthodox tradition, or because of doing things that have moved from the Orthodox direction. What's going on there?
I'll get to that in the third lecture, because it has absolutely everything to do with what's going on in this church. And what will be interesting for me to see is to join a Protestant church, go forward at an altar call, maybe have a few 101, 201, 301 classes, get baptized, you're in. To join an Orthodox church, year of catechesis. Even at the end of the year, maybe they'll let you in, maybe they won't. A lot of people are going that way now. 2-3 years from now, we'll see. I'm sure some will endure. Many others, we'll see. But the reason for this, I think, is exactly the right question to ask, because it gets into a lot of the deeper stuff that we're going to get into with respect to the Protestant Reformation, what sacraments mean, and it gets into philosophically what is a human being and the trajectory that the West has taken and why, in a sense, we've painted ourselves into a corner.